The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly. You heard a squeaky bum time. This was a gale from the bottom half at Selhurst Park in Crystal Palace, Liverpool, as it caps a weekend of raw emotion. Fans in tears, Ashley Cole in tears, Luis Suarez in tears. Heartbreaking sight, and Ashley Cole in tears. Football Weekly gathers up the hankies, puts the onions away, and tries a brave smile as we round up, without question, the most newsworthy weekend in football. Not just in the Premier League, but in the Football League with their grand finale in Spain, where even a weekend of surprises didn't prepare us for that Ronaldo goal, and in Italy with shootings, a cup win for Napoli and Juve's third straight title. All of that in today's Football Weekly. Wow. Wow, people. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. That was football. My word. Greg Bukowski's here.
Hi, James.
Hi, Greg. Jacob Steinberg's here.
Hello.
And Barry Glendenning's here. Barry.
Hello.
Hi, Barry. Right. What happened last night then, Greg? Look, well, Nazi.
Well, what happened last night is
Istanbul in reverse.
Yeah, yeah. Istanbul, all those gags. What happened last night is kind of what's happened this season in Liverpool's defence, in that they defended appallingly on a grand scale. Pressure got to them, and I mean, they've run away with games this season, I think, because of an imbalance in the team, in that they're set up to attack, and that in itself is what has enabled the title charge, I think, is in that everything has been geared up to attack and they've steamrolled teams. I think they've got to the business end of a title challenge in which there's a lot of players who've got no experience of how to handle that, and the pressure did get to them last night. Like, as soon as that first goal came in, there's so many Liverpool fans who were thinking, oh, hang on, this isn't good, Liverpool's arses have gone on a number of the last few games, particularly even the Man City game. There's been a fragility there which has been obvious.
Well, a lot of people after the game were saying what fools they were, how naive, why didn't Rodgers tell them to sit back and defend the lead?
But they've not been set up to do that all season, and they're not. How do you do that if you've not done it all season and do it effectively? I mean, against Norwich, he brought Agger on, and he could have done that.
Right, last but night. Should he have done? I mean, my question was: was what he was doing so wrong? He was taking a gamble. It wasn't a gamble that paid off. It backfired spectacularly. But in many senses, a 3-0 win wasn't that much good to Liverpool. They have to assume Man City will win. They have to assume that they had to try and narrow that goal difference.
But the talk of what Rodgers should do next before Palace scored was take Lucas off and put Coutinho on and try and chase down 5-6 goals, which I thought might have been even a better way of defending it than is what happened, which was to take Sterling off, who's a very industrious player, and put Coutinho on, who's a bit more flighty. Into that team. I think it's crass to kind of try and apportion blame and point fingers after that result, given the season that Liverpool have had.
Right.
Look at it with a sense of perspective, and it's been a fantastic season.
Right. I mean, the other thing is that 3-0 up into the second half against a team with effectively nothing left to play for, you could almost have assumed that the other team weren't going to be that bothered about it, but then, most teams' heads would have gone down by that point, but most teams aren't Crystal Palace.
Well, I think that there was that sense when Liverpool went up 3-0 up quite early in the second half, you thought, right, they really could go and score a hatful here. And it almost got a little bit too easy for them. You see that in games sometimes, where sometimes that intensity drops a little bit, and they still got themselves into good positions in the Palace area and so on. And it was sometimes they sort of dithering and the wrong pass here and there, because it probably was a little bit too easy, and you sort of end up in that situation let's try and show off a little bit and score the perfect goal. I think that's just sort of natural, that sometimes happens in football. And then kind of the game drifted a little bit, and Palace then score a goal that really was as deflection from outside the area, the centre back score, putting one in the top corner. It had nothing probably to do with anything that Liverpool did wrong defensively. That's just something that can happen. But then after that, to get caught so badly on the counter attack about a minute or two later is just smacks of a bit of naivety that they're a young side who haven't really been in that position for a long. Certainly, this side hasn't been, and Liverpool as a club haven't been in that position for a long time in the title race. So You know, you would have expected a Chelsea or a City probably to close that out, and Liverpool will learn from it. But they've had a great season, though.
Well, they have. Yeah. And so have Palace. Palace, who'd scored about three goals all season, suddenly do that late hat-trick.
Well, as far as I know, no team has scored fewer goals than Palace from open play this season, and they deserve a huge amount of credit for sticking at their task and trying to and get a result, because nothing to play for. But then I suppose their players are all aware of the famous incident between Pulis and James Beattie, and none of them want to be attacked by a naked, dripping wet Mr. Pulis in the dressing room, which I imagine is a truly terrifying experience.
Was he not wearing a hat?
Possibly, and a towel, I'm not sure. But, you know, it's one of those nights. In the second half, everything went wrong for Brendan Rodgers, and everything went right for Pulis. His substitutions were inspired. And, I mean, playing in front of that crowd, I've said before on the pod that the atmosphere at Selhurst Park is invariably fantastic. I remember being there a couple of seasons ago when they were still in the Championship, playing Bolton on a day when it was just bitterly cold and really, really unpleasant, and even it was a horrible 0-0 draw, and even then they cheered the team to the rafters throughout. And it must be a huge incentive when you're getting that kind of encouragement and enthusiasm raining down from the stands. I mean, Liverpool got it as well, because when they went 3-0 up, their visiting fans were chanting, you know, at them to attack, attack. And that was their undoing in the end. I mean, you say a 3-0 win wouldn't have been much good to them, but it's certainly better, would have been better than a 3-3 draw.
No, indeed. Although they are still top of the table as we await the midweek clash between Aston Villa and Man City.
Well, that was the thing that I found funny. Like, I mean, if you had said to Greg or any other Liverpool fan before the start of the season, one game to go, you'd be a point clear at the top of the table. No one could possibly have imagined how annoyed and distraught they would have been by that possibility.
There's been a banner on the cup the second half of the season, which has been this maker's dream thing. And I think, you know, the players have succeeded in doing that. And lots of Liverpool fans did dream of winning a 19th title. And it looks like it's going to remain a dream now.
Were you surprised at how upset Luis Suarez was at the end? Or was he putting his shirt over his head to cover the fact that he wasn't crying?
I thought that was interesting, in that he obviously thought Liverpool would win with a really fantastic chance of winning the title still last night. Whereas I think the damage was done against Chelsea, and that to lose all that momentum with that defeat and for it to be out of Liverpool's hands at that point, I'm surprised he wasn't crying then rather than after this Palace game.
A lot of people who were clever would say that the damage was done when Jordan Henderson picked up his red card against City.
Yeah, well, it's possible Suarez was laughing because his shoulders were shaking the way they do, you know, when you hear something really, really funny happens and you just lose it, corpse completely. And maybe he didn't want people to see him laughing, so he could pull his shirt over his face.
He was laughing at one point, I think, when they scored the third goal, sort of at the sheer bizarreness of the situation.
Well, he must have just been, perhaps he was laughing because he's thinking, how could I score so many goals this season and this happen?
You know? How
this indeed? Because they have a rubbish defence.
Well, it hasn't happened yet, though, Greg, in terms of the title. What are the chances, then, that Villa spring this last surprise or another surprise?
Oh, Villa are going to draw. For sure they're going to draw.
Yeah?
And yeah, you just know that City will draw with Villa now, and it won't matter because City will still go on and win the final game and win the league. I just think there's that kind of butterfly effect where, you know, City will see that we've cocked up, Liverpool have cocked up, and then give them, you know, kind of take the foot off the gas somewhat. And it might still go to goal difference. I can just sense that happening.
All right. Villa have won at Arsenal. They've beaten Manchester City at home. They defeated Chelsea at Villa Park and drawn at Liverpool this season. In fact, as far as I can recall, I read from somewhere else, outside the top four, they have the best record of any team against the top four, or something like that.
Well, they were fantastic on the counter-attack when they came to Anfield. And at that point, I think they may have had a few wins and the pressure was feeling like it was off slightly, and that's when they seem to cut free. They're without Benteke and Agbonlahor, I think.
Agbonlahor limped off in the 3-1 win over Hull.
Yeah.
Is he definitely out?
I've heard that Benteke and Agbonlahor both going to be missing, therefore that's...
They'll have Wyman, won't they, Andres Wyman?
He's resurgent again.
He's resurgent. He got two against the Tigers.
Yeah, very pacey. I mean, they'll need him to have any chance, but I can just see Villa drawn in.
You can get 20-1 against Villa beating City, which I think is fairly unlikely, but surely worth the punt. It's a three-horse race, you know, win, lose, draw. It's been such a bonkers season, you know. Would you confidently put the farm on City winning?
I wouldn't bet the farm on it, no.
You don't have a farm.
I don't have a farm to bet. Even if I did, I think I'd like to take more care of it than just willy-nilly gambling.
City are going to win the league now, though, aren't they? I mean, they've got...
You're trying that reverse kind of...
reverse Rodgers, they call it. Well, no, just they've got a good defence, they've got a very good midfield and a great attack. Chelsea have got a great defence, very good midfield, a crap attack. Liverpool have got a crap defence, very good midfield and a great attack. So City have got it in all three areas, and they're the team that are going to win the league because of that.
They had a bit of a scare, though, didn't they, on Saturday? I don't know if you remember that far back. Goodison Park, Everton, Man City. And interesting game, weird atmosphere. With a lot of conflicted Everton fans, I guess.
There's a lot of conflicted Everton fans. I don't think there were as many when the match actually arrived who were conflicted who were at that game.
But it was a very quiet game, and it was only later on in the game I thought that the home fans started to really get behind Everton in what was a stirring comeback attempt. A stirring comeback attempt that featured one of the goals of the season for Ross Barkley.
It was a fantastic goal, and I thought City showed the resilience there that in other games they haven't shown. I mean, they could have closed off the away game at Arsenal when they drew. They could have won that easily. I think they could have beaten Liverpool easily. Earlier on in the season, they had a vulnerability about them. I thought at Everton, when Everton came back and made it 3-2, they drew themselves together. And I think, you know, they have got leaders on the pitch, and perhaps you could say, you know, Gerrard is a leader, but in defence they've got company who can organise. I think Liverpool haven't got an organiser in defence in the same way even that Chelsea haven't.
That comment that Rodgers made about it being easy to coach a team to defend with 10 men on the 18-yard box, sort of, it's actually come back to bite him a little bit, and it just shows that it's not easy to do that. And I think there's a lot of teams now where the defending has sort of become a bit of a lost art, especially for the top side. You look at Bayern Munich last week, not able to defend a corner properly, and Barcelona as well are the same. And you know, sometimes there's so much focus on this brilliant attacking that sometimes the defending loses a little bit of value. And Chelsea have gone probably too far in that way, in that they can't. He hasn't probably got the front end of the team right, Mourinho. But in terms of defence, then if you were to combine the two teams, Liverpool and Chelsea, you'd have one of the most formidable teams of all time.
Getting the balance is so difficult.
You'd have 22 players. That'd be
If you combine the two mentalities.
Well, anyway, so Aguero's limped off again. Don't know how much we feel with Dzeko, resurgent. Yeah, Man City, Villa.
They've got such strength in the squad that, I mean, they can field a team that could comfortably beat Villa. I'm just, from a point of view, feeling a bit disappointed this morning. I could just imagine it's going to be a draw.
It's interesting, though, that if
City... Did you cry?
No.
Have you ever cried? About football.
I have cried about things. Have I ever cried about football? I think when I was very young, when I was a kid. I mean, I've grown up since then.
Yeah. Have you cried at football, Jacob?
No. And I've seen us go down twice, lose a playoff final, lose a final in the last minute to Greg's lot.
So. Barry, I can see you blubbing over a game involving 22 men running around in shorts.
No.
Really? No?
Never.
Good for you.
I've cried after losing a game that I was playing in.
Ah.
But not watch.
Really?
So you did the Suarez, did you? Did you pull your shirt over your face?
No,
and
it wasn't like a full-on shoulders racking and sobbing. I still think he was laughing, but... just tears.
Did you just wipe one tear away and kind of, you know, in a stiff upper lip kind of way?
I'd love to see a slow-mo of that. You stare off into the distance, manfully. Greg, on the subject of Man City, interesting that if your prophecy is fulfilled and they do win the league, the team that's used the fewest players this season will win the league, and the team that used the most players will go down. So have that squad rotation.
Yeah, and much of this season has been based on momentum, I think. You know, Liverpool's momentum.
Yeah.
I do think having a slimmed down squad of players and having them being used to each other and how they play is particularly useful. And if you look at Gus Poyet in the last four games, he's named the same 11 and they have done the business for him in some huge matches. And perhaps there's something to be said for a lack of squad rotation.
Why?
In Spain, Atletico.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Well, we'll talk about that later on. We'll talk about Sunderland in a bit as well, because I think we'll finish off part one with an in-depth look at Chelsea-Norwich.
How long?
How long you got, Jacob?
Well, as long as
were
possible.
Were you there?
No.
Who was there? Anyone there? Was there? No? Okay, anybody?
I saw the first half, I think, and then I decided I can't, you know, stay
and
in.
Yeah, there was such a story building there, wasn't there? The Canaries. I thought they were going
to
win this.
I had to go to the park with my wife and daughter. I couldn't.
Interesting pre-game as well, because of course this was after our last pod. I think it was on the Friday, wasn't it, that Jose came out. We'd mentioned last week what Eden Hazard said to Be In Sports about this team not being built to play football. And Mourinho had one or two observations about what Hazard's built to do. He's built to be selfish. That was one thing. He's built to not sacrifice himself for his team, built to not admit his mistakes, built to cost us our place in the final. That was largely Jose's press conference about Hazard on Friday. Mm. It's interesting. There's the curse of the player of the year. You had Mata, who's player of the year, and has now been sent off to Old Trafford. And Hazard on the bench this weekend as he collected his player of the season award.
He's their best player as well, Hazard. But it's true, there is too much pressure on him because Oscar's kind of slowed down. Mourinho was talking about this as well, I think, on Sunday, for the Sunday papers, about how Oscar's thinks he's possibly playing now for the World Cup, which a few Chelsea fans have said to me over the course of the last few months. And, you know, Salah, he's not quite settled in yet, and Schürrle is sort of a good direct player, but he's a finisher and a bit of a runner. He's not got a lot of creativity to him. And William's a really good player, but he doesn't score enough or maybe create enough at times, not decisive enough. And you do look in those games sometimes when the teams do sit back against them, Chelsea, and think you really could have done with one Mata there.
All right.
Ultimately, is that tactic? I mean, that tactic of Mourinho was, I think, player power has grown in the last 10, 12 years since he was first at Chelsea. And talking to players in that way now, maybe, you know.
Well, there is a line of thought that Hazard's basically received so many plaudits this year that this was his opportunity after Hazard came out and said something a little bit controversial on Wednesday. This was Mourinho's opportunity to just to take him down a peg or two, like, you know, because he had actually contributed. He was in some ways responsible for which was, I think, the first Atletico goal?
The first and the third goals.
You talk to the player in private, maybe, first, rather than go public with it. I mean, that's...
Yeah. You drop him for that, you know, that final must-win game, your best player.
No, with you on that, I don't know. But this was the argument that in some ways it was Mourinho just putting him back in line. But his touch with the dressing room, maybe not what it was, as we saw at Real Madrid last year, of course.
Well, apparently he tore into Nemanja Matic and Mohamed Salah at half-time, according to reports in the Mail yesterday, and told Salah that he should come back for pre-season, quote, ready to be a footballer, unquote. So, you know, I don't know. Every week we're discussing Mourinho's latest.
Let's talk about Ashley Cole. Outburst.
It's very tedious, to be honest.
Can we talk about Ashley Cole?
Yeah.
In tears.
Yeah, all this crying.
A lot of tears this weekend.
Tears and recriminations.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. Because that's the end of it's an end of an era, isn't it, really?
Maybe. He was saying they might stay.
Oh.
Mourinho.
Is that why he was crying?
I imagine he wants him to stay because he's a manager who likes to have players in his dressing room who he feels he can give messages to and spread it around the squad. And I think he needs to find replacements for those players, such as, I mean, like, say a player like Materazzi at Inter. He really liked Materazzi. He may have been one of the more limited players, but he was the player who thought summed up. He was the heart of the club. I think he's got John Terry, who's at Chelsea, who's a bit like that, and Lampard was there. Drogba, when he was there, kind of had that feel around him, and he hasn't got those.
His lieutenants.
He's not got his lieutenants around that squad now, and he's got the new breed coming through and the old guard going out, and he needs to find some players who are going to be able to replace, you know, the players who he sees as the heart of Chelsea, and I think he might struggle if he doesn't do that successfully.
It's really surprising that they've managed to draw with Norwich at home and lose to Sunderland at home. It's really not what you'd expect of a Mourinho side, and didn't expect them to be the ones almost to throw it away, because if they won the last four games, then fairly easy games apart from the Liverpool one, one would have won the league.
Yeah.
They've thrown away so many stupid points this season.
None of which is Mourinho's fault, of course, as he's made abundantly clear. Well, the point doesn't really help Norwich, as we'll talk about in a second or two, because that's probably enough for part one. A little bit of music, and then on to that battle at the bottom with extra Man United Sunderland.
Hello, Football Weekly listeners. With the end of the season fast approaching, we've clubbed together with The Guardian Bookshop to bring you an exclusive offer to get 50% off two brand new sports books. If, like Jose Mourinho, you think you can make better decisions than most referees, you can now test your mettle with 160 fiendishly difficult football dilemmas in You Are the Ref Volume 3. And if you fancy something a bit more highbrow, you can also pre-order The Highlights, a collection of the best writing by legendary Guardian sports journalist Frank Keating. To get your copies of The Highlights and You Are the Ref Volume 3 at 50% off, head to guardianbookshop.co.uk and enter the offer code SPORT. You've got until the 23rd of May, and remember, it's only available to you because you listen to Football Weekly.
Yeah, Norwich with that point from Stamford Bridge, 2 points still behind Sunderland, who have a game in hand and a massively superior goal difference. Norwich's only chance now to stay in the Premier League is that Sunderland lose both their next two games, which are Wednesday night at home to West Brom, and then at home to Swansea at the weekend, and hope, meantime, that Norwich beat Arsenal. Norwich basically have to beat Arsenal, hope Sunderland lose their next two games, or hope that West Brom lose both games with a 19-goal swing, because West Brom are 3 points better off. West Brom, of course, are at Sunderland Wednesday night, and then at home to Stoke. Doesn't really look likely. Sunderland, West Brom, the key game, obviously, on Wednesday night, and Sunderland coming in off that victory away to Man United, which frankly we saw coming, and I was surprised more people didn't. Barry,
did we see it coming?
I think we did, even if we didn't say so on Thursday. I'm pretty sure we did say so.
I was surprised. I expected Manchester United to win that, but Sunderland's resurgence in the last few games has been utterly remarkable. I don't really understand what's happened.
Greg was pointing out that
he's named the same team for four games on the bounce, which is perhaps helps and, you know, to some kind of understanding among those players and spirit of kind of all together, you know.
And it's helped as well.
Yeah, Barini's been very good. Yeah.
And plus, Man United actually weren't all that good against Norwich. Sunderland were 7 points adrift 4 games ago, it says here. That's crazy. And now they're out 2 points out of the bottom three. But is there a chance they'll be docked those points, Barry?
It looks unlikely. The Premier League have said that if Norwich, Cardiff and Fulham gang up and try to launch a legal action to have Sunderland dock points, that the legal action would fail.
Cool.
I think they have a case. Not a very strong one, but yeah, I mean, so the fact of the matter is Sunderland did field an ineligible player, but it was just a very minor administrative sort of clerical error, rather. He was the registered Sunderland player. It's just someone had forgotten to fill it out of form. There was no attempt at deception or anything, and when, as soon as they realised the mistake, they brought it to the Premier League's attention. So,
There wasn't an attempt at deception, but it was interesting how the Premier League attempted to bury the whole thing. They wanted this to go out without anybody actually knowing about the fine instead of the points penalty. And they've been really draconian with some clubs lower down the kind of footballing pyramid.
Well, I said at the time that I thought a points deduction would be fair enough. But admittedly, that was when I thought sort of we're going to get relegated anyway. But, you know, I mean, they did earn 1 point from fielding an ineligible player.
Was that game? You have very little to do with that.
Oh, I'd imagine so. I mean, he didn't perform at all, apart from scoring a goal against Manchester City once, you know, a couple of seasons ago. His impact at Sunderland has been minimal.
Mm. The player in question, Barry?
G.
All right.
Who famously scored the goal against Manchester City
on
a couple of seasons ago.
New Year's Day, wasn't it, or something?
Yeah.
You can't not mention. You can't not mention Conor Wickham as well if you're talking about Sunderland now. Yep. Can you? You've just got to talk about Conor Wickham at any moment. I wonder if is he connected the dots in terms of, you know, you've got a player now who the ball kind of sticks with when it goes forward, where that wasn't really happening with Altidore and any other player who was playing instead, and he just seems to have added, you know, some.
Well, he scored goals, but three or four.
Well, he had the hand in the goal against United, didn't he?
Of course.
Yeah, I just wonder whether his presence.
About who worked with him as a kid in January when he was, out on loan. I don't know where he was.
He was at Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah, and they sort of he was sort of talking about how some players they get a move too early or put into the first team too early when they're young, and he was Connor Wickham might be a player like that. You know, he might have gone too early to Sunderland, and he didn't do a lot. What was it? 3 years ago? It's about 2.5 years ago now that he joined Sunderland for quite a lot of money. And he looked like a really good player. Yeah, but now we can see maybe why they did that. I mean, he was bigged up as going to be a huge talent as when he was at Ipswich as a kid. So,
but I mean, he's still only a kid. He's only 21.
Mm.
So,
yeah,
it's quite understandable, for a 17-year-old. Big money move, you might lose the run of yourself a bit, go to your head, but he seems to have the tools to go far, and hopefully he will.
Certainly does. And other people are saying about on the plane to World Cupness in Brazil. Jake, no. Shake your head, but maybe there'll be a seat free because World Cup Rooney fitness klaxon, because he didn't play against Sunderland.
No, he's got a groin injury,
a recurring groin injury.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's got over a month for that to get right.
He's got over a month to break his foot.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I assume then he won't be playing when Man United take on Hull on Tuesday night in a game that may already have taken place by the time you hear this, a listener. Man United Hull. Well, we've got loads of other big things to discuss, but we should mention Van Gaal. Is he going to sign this week, the latest? What's the...
Apparently so, and the word is that he will offer Ryan Giggs a senior coaching role rather than bring Patrick Kluivert in with him. But Kluivert's his one of his lieutenants in the Dutch camp.
Mm.
And it was widely presumed that he and Danny Blind would join Van Gaal at Old Trafford, but it seems now that Kluivert may not, and Giggs will get a very senior role instead.
Oh.
Tonight, or Manchester United's game against Hull City could be Giggs' last game for United. Certainly at Old Trafford.
Apparently he might play himself.
Really? Yeah. Interesting. Hull, meantime, are going to be in Europe next season because of Arsenal sealing their top four status for another season. So, because Hull are the FA Cup
Put money on them to get relegated next season
in the
Europa League.
Right. Now, speaking...
Their attempts to... sort of increase their global brand are proving a success. They've already annexed one continent.
Tigers in Europe. Excellent. Now, you spoke about relegation there. Fulham are down. Wow, how good did Stoke look in the bits that I saw?
They look, on the counter-attack. This goes to show they're perfectly equipped to take on this possession football with their speedy counter-attack, Stoke.
Mm.
They'd have no problem at all against Barcelona. Just hit them on the break the whole time.
Yeah.
Asaidi, Odemwingi and Arnautovic playing as a three. They're all very talented players and very different to the way that Stoke have played for quite a long time.
Mm. Fulham are down, Jacob.
I know, it's really disappointing.
Down.
Best away ground in the country.
And sent down by the manager who accused them of not having enough ambition. And some would say it was too much ambition which killed them. I don't know if they'd be right to say that. Probably nobody says that, but it's sounding like a good line at the time. But they have got a strong youth setup, as was demonstrated by their stirring performance in the youth FA Cup final against Chelsea.
Yeah, they lost in the end, 7-6 on aggregate. But yeah, it was a really close game.
Mm.
They won the first leg, I believe, 3-2, and then ended up losing the second game. But they've got a lot of talented players there.
Right.
So maybe Magath, who says he wants to stay, might not. I think his contract now runs out.
Right. But I'm not sure if that the right way for them to go with Magath? 3 wins in 11 for him.
That's a set. They've had the same record. The three managers they've had, I think they've all had 3 wins and been, bombed out after 10, 11, 12 games. So it's been shambolic the way they've run that club. I mean, they brought Wilkins in and... and Kerbs, and then they were gone by February. I mean, it's just... Shahid Khan is,
right.
He's gone in there and really cut things up
horrendously.
And what must be going through the mind of Kostas Mitroglou?
Wait,
he was He was on. He was going to be facing a last 16 Champions League tie against Manchester United, and he was in form. He was playing very well before that.
Mm.
Could have, maybe if he'd have been in the Olympiakos team, perhaps, you know, got Olympiakos over the line against United and been in a quarter final of the European Cup. Instead, he goes to Fulham. He turns up and apparently isn't fit, hardly features, and finds himself a Championship player next season.
Some of the press briefings with Maggot about him, it's every week where he gets asked about him. He goes, no, he's not fit. He'll be back next week. Is he here this week? No, he's not fit yet. He's not fit enough. He'll be back next week. So obviously had a look at him and just didn't fancy him at all.
I was looking yesterday at Fulham's list of record signings. Mitroglou is a record signing, 12 million. And then Steve Marley, who cost, I think, about 10 million many, many years ago, when 10 million was a huge amount of money. Brian Ruiz, who's been a disaster. Andy Johnson, who hasn't done very well for them. And then you've Edwin van der Sar, who was a good signing.
Right.
But so their list of top five record signings, four of them were complete rubbish.
Well, there you go. Cardiff are also down, eh? They lost 2-0 to Newcastle.
3-0.
Oh, was it 3 in the end?
Yeah, Stephen Taylor scored.
Oh, of course he did, and that was a historic goal, and that. Because it was the first goal scored by an Englishman for Newcastle since Christmas 2012.
Wow.
Yeah.
What to say about Cardiff again?
Well, let's talk about Newcastle then, and their massive walkout that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. But, yeah.
It sort of happened.
A little bit.
There was, I'd say, 7,000 or 8,000 fans left, but apparently now the fans, some of the fans who did walk out were abusing some of the fans who didn't, and
ooh,
some of the fans and vice versa. We, you know, so it didn't really work as a protest, because it seems to have just turned some fans against each other, which, you know, they could do with a bit of solidarity. Michael Martin, who writes the True Faith, or edits the True Faith fanzine, he has described the experience of supporting Newcastle United under Mike Ashley as a big ball ache, and says it's an exercise in joyless defeatism, which I think pretty much hits the nail on the head. And he says Newcastle's lack of ambition is suffocating. Yeah, so I mean, he's been bangs the drum week after week. He's just so fed up, and you know, I think he speaks on behalf of a very sizable proportion of Newcastle fans. It's not difficult to see why they're completely...
Every time they've been on the verge of doing something good and going places, they've sold players and not replaced them, and then the team suffered as a consequence. You can understand why the fans...
That amazing
that
stat.
Way.
Don't know if, did we mention this last week? That when the next transfer window opens, whenever is that, June? 1st of June? It will have been 18 months since they signed a permanent first-team player.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as Michael Martin says, it's a suffocating lack of ambition. And it must be very frustrating to support a team that whose owner has no apparent interest in bringing them on. He just wants to stay in the Premier League. Doesn't want to be in the Europa League. No interest in qualifying for Europe. And you'd imagine, I think they could possibly get relegated next season.
Ooh.
Kabay's last game was at Upton Park, and he absolutely ran the show and scored two goals and was brilliant, and they won 3-1. And I think it was 10 days later he went to PSG. But afterwards, Pardew was asked, I think they were some 7th, 8th or something, really challenging for the Europa League places, and he was asked, what about the Europa League? Then he goes, oh, no, we don't talk about that.
There you go. All right. Also this weekend, Saints won at Swansea just at the death, and it wasn't a really interesting game. Arsenal beat West Brom, and...
Remy was there.
Yeah, that's like mystery surrounds the appearance of Loic Remy at Emirates.
Yeah. Wenger said he hoped he paid for a ticket because he didn't invite him.
Is it worth mentioning something about Cardiff as soon as he got relegated? I know I said what to say about them, and then we just talked about Newcastle.
Yeah.
No, just how sorry I feel for the fans in that they have had a season in the Premier League, and at no point have they really been able to enjoy it.
Well, they had some early times so they could enjoy.
I don't know. With Vincent Tan in charge, and there was rumbling so early on in the season about him and Malky Mackay. And
was funny though when they became relegated, and on the Sky ticker their name goes in red, and people are saying Vincent Tan's finally got them in the red. Not funny if you're a Cardiff fan, obviously. Anyway, down they go. But let's finish off our Premier League roundup by saying West Ham beat Spurs again, Jacob. Again,
I know, third time. Yeah,
what's going on there?
Spurs have absolutely no bottle at all. Honest, they've got a lot of good players, but you could tell very quickly after the first whistle that they weren't really up for it. And, you know, West Ham is not a particularly vibrant attacking side, but they've got a lot more heart at times in this Tottenham side, and I don't think they didn't seem to be playing for poor old Tim.
No.
Not particularly, not with that ridiculousness over the free kick, Adebayor and Paulinho.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, ducking out the way of that thunderbolt from Stuart Downing.
Right, and then that thunderous stare which Adebayor unleashed on his colleague.
Yeah.
Mm. What about West Ham next weekend to stifle City at the Etihad?
They've kept 14 clean sheets. Mm. They did lose 6-0 at the Etihad last time they played them.
Oh, so, all right then.
Although they had no defenders in that game.
Right.
Roger Johnson played in that game.
Hmm. Will Big Sam be up for that one?
Maybe. I don't know. Who knows with him?
Okay.
He would enjoy it if he
did. Will Andy Carroll be fit for that one? He's played a few games now, hasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he had the header on for Harry Kane's own goal.
Maybe it's not over. Maybe it's not over. Part two is, though, after this. Hey, little bit of football league then, from Brighton at one end to Birmingham at the other. Late drama in the Championship.
Yeah, Birmingham scored a 94th minute equaliser against Bolton, which kept them up and sent Doncaster down. Birmingham, Skip has skin in the teeth. They were 2-0 down, looked dead and buried, but somehow got it back. And then there was a playoff place up for grabs as well, and Reading looked home and hosed for that. Their fans were on the pitch celebrating.
They thought it was over, but it wasn't.
Yeah, and Brighton scored a very late winner against Forest away from home, which consigned Reading to 7th place.
Mm.
And no playoffs for them.
No, so it's Derby against Brighton and QPR Wigan in the playoffs. Leicester and Burnley go up. Doncaster, Barnsley and Yeovil get relegated. In League One, Wolves finish with 103 points, which is an all-time record for the third tier. They beat Carlisle 3-0 over the weekend. Carlisle go down. Brentford are going up into the Championship. Orient, Rotherham, Preston and Peterborough in the playoffs. We've not covered this all year, but we're apparently now going to do it in great detail now. And, League Two was ever so exciting, because there was only one point between the top three going into the final weekend. Chesterfield ended up as champions after a second-half fight back against Fleetwood. Scunthorpe second, and yes, Jacob, Rochdale third after they drew and lost their final games. And Rochdale had been league leaders going into these last few matches, but the top three, of course, go automatically up.
And Bristol Rovers got relegated. 94 years. 94 years in the Football League. Now they're gone.
Gone. Who came up?
Luton have come up, and the playoffs, your occasional supply presenter, Max Rushton's Cambridge, have beaten Halifax, and they take on Gateshead in the final of the conference playoff.
Oh, okay, top knowledge. Now, in Europe, all sorts of drama in Italy, just for a change, on Saturday. It was a weekend that saw all sorts of things happening. Roma lost 4-1 away to Catania, who hadn't really scored many goals before this, and Roma were on that unbeaten run. I think they won 9 in a row coming into this game, but they lost 4-1, and that meant that Juve were crowned champions for the third straight time. Milan won the derby. That now means they're 3 points behind Inter in the race for a Europa League place. Who scored the goal? De Jong, surprisingly enough, with a header. I think it's only his second goal for the club. It wasn't a great game. It was entertaining. It was a derby
in
that.
Did you see the Juventus-Benfica game?
Yes, I did.
It was a bit disappointing.
Yes, it was. It was.
They had chances in the first half.
They had chances, but...
In the first half.
They created a lot of chances, but I think there must be questions asked now about Conte, not just because he's an appallingly bad loser. The way he ranted on about Clattenburg and the wrong team's gone through to the final. Benfica...
They had a long time as well with 10 men.
Mm.
It was about half an hour.
Half an hour, 35 minutes, I think, yeah. Yeah. He has just won the title for the third straight time, but a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth come Saturday morning in the Italian press, Friday morning indeed, because this has moved Portugal definitively past Italy in the UEFA coefficient rankings, and Italy have dropped to their lowest point in 30 years now. But
where are they?
They're fifth now. Yeah. And Benfica, I think, are the fifth best ranked team for what it's worth in Europe, UEFA coefficient wise. So in some sense, there's no disgrace to losing their place in the final. But obviously, with the final being in Turin, Juve rather thought that they were.
And against 10 men.
Yeah.
They needed one goal.
Mm. Zanetti didn't come on. Mazzarri won himself no friends at Inter by not bringing Zanetti on for what would have been his final derby appearance, because he's hanging up his boots at the end of the season. He's played in 47 derbies. He couldn't find room for him in what was an absolutely insipid Inter performance. Palermo are up to Serie A after the weekend's action, so that'll be entertaining at least next season.
How many managers?
My friend was there for the
was he?
Yeah, just in the city and took loads of photographs of,
right.
of all the celebrations and everything. I think he wants some kind of gallery on the Guardian.
Oh right.
Yeah.
Well, there were lovely scenes. They're in the pink in a very real sense.
Yeah. Is Kyle Lafferty still playing?
Yes. Yes.
Kyle Lafferty's going to be playing in Serie A.
Well, he may be. He may be. Yeah. But, of course, the big story was the Coppa Italia on Saturday evening, which, you know, put all those worries about coefficients a little bit in second tier, because extraordinary news story, even before the game kicked off. You've no doubt seen this. I mean, there was a lot of varying rumours about what actually happened, but basically, the official version now is that this one Roma fan provoked a fight with a group of Napoli fans. When they chased him, he stumbles, falls over, and draws a gun and just starts firing at them. And he shoots three of them. One of them, seriously, he's got a bullet lodged in his spine. He's now in hospital alongside the Roma fan, Daniele De Sanctis, who actually shot him, because he was beaten to a merry pulp by, of course, the Napoli fans who he'd failed to shoot, and was taken to...
But he's not just any old Roma fan,
no,
is he?
No, he's not. Well... Yeah, it's a long story, this. So basically, after the word gets out that a Napoli fan or Napoli fans have been shot, the Napoli fans who are elsewhere in the city begin to kick off a bit, and there's just a really bad atmosphere as we head into the game. Inside the stadium, the Napoli fans have heard that a Napoli fan has now died, so they're now suddenly folding up all their banners and preparing for some nasty scenes of their own, and insisting that the game should not be played. Now, you mentioned that he's not just any fan, Massimo De Sanctis, he's the referee, Daniele De Sanctis, because he was involved in 2004 when there was the infamous Rome derby, in which a rumour went round that a young fan had been run over by a police car and killed, and the Roma and Lazio fans, principally the Roma fans, insisted that the game would not go ahead. They called Totti over. Totti comes back to the centre circle and says, not shielding his mouth properly, these guys are going to kill us if we go ahead. And so the game was suspended. It was one of the darkest days of Italian football in that
long time. Well,
it was
pretty shameful, yeah.
Yeah. And similar scenes this time around. Now, police insist that they didn't negotiate with the Napoli fans to let the game go ahead, but it looked like that was what was happening. Basically, the Napoli captain, Marek Hamšík, went over to the area under the fans. Originally, he went with a whole load of stewards and security staff with them, but the Napoli fans threw fireworks and flares at them until they went away. And then you have this scene of he and a couple of other officials talking to principally a guy called Jenny Acaronia, or Jenny the Swine. And there was a long kind of negotiation with him. The police say that he was just, Hamšík was just there to inform the Napoli fans of the fact that no Fiorentina fans had been involved in the shooting and that the guy hadn't died, and therefore could they just calm down a bit. But it did look as though they were saying, listen, please don't kick off, we'd like to go ahead with this game. But it's just amazing scenes of to all intents and purposes, looked like the fixture, the Coppa Italia final, being held hostage by a guy who A, is the son of an alleged Camorra associate, B, is wearing a T-shirt.
Be careful what you say here, Jimbo.
Well, Barry, we've had our own discussion
about
this.
Everyone.
Well,
by stating a fact.
Well, I don't think if you were to choose one fact to say about the city of Naples, then I think that people might be upset if you made that the one fact. But moving on, basically, had the scene of the Coppa Italia final, the final of the Italian Cup, at the Stadio Olimpico in Rome, with present the head of the Italian Senate and the Italian Prime Minister, Matteo Renzi.
And the head of the Anti-Mafia Commission.
Was he also there?
Yes.
Magnificent.
Or is it a woman? I'm not sure. Rosie Bindi?
Oh, yeah, she's a woman.
Yes.
Yeah. And so basically they're all stood there with the rest of the stadium, with all the head honchos of Italian football, waiting for this bloke in a black T-shirt saying, release Speziali. Speziali, meantime, is a bloke, a Catania fan, who's in prison for throwing a lump of concrete onto a policeman's head, who subsequently died, or died rather immediately, in fact. in a very, very famous case, another of those dark days. So he's basically being there negotiated with by the captain of one of the teams, and then eventually it all goes ahead. And we actually have a really terrific game. I don't know if any of you saw this, but it was a stirring performance from Napoli, a stirring comeback attempt from a weakened Fiorentina side, and a 3-1 win for Napoli.
Are attempts being made in Italy to, like, for fans not to have this much power? Well, clubs actively trying to do something, because in Britain, you know, there's an issue with fans. You know, be nice if fans were listened to more. I mean, in Italy, it's on another level.
Well,
isn't
that's the interesting thing, that there is something quite interesting about ultra power in Italy, which is that there, a situation like Cardiff, you can't really imagine happening, because if somebody came in and wanted to change, say, Atalanta's shirt, I don't think they'd get very far, because the fans would make it extremely impossible for them to continue as owner of the club, or the club to indeed function. And the same is true of many clubs. But obviously, this is what's happened is completely unacceptable. And the main problem is that, well, the problem's huge.
Well, the fans have got like this like aggrandized idea to themselves, I imagine.
Well, is it aggrandized? They see themselves as every bit as important in the setup of football. Without
the fans, surely that cuts their behaviour. The fact that they feel that they've got so much power makes them feel they're able to go, you know, run amok on the streets.
I don't think it's wrong for them to feel that they should have an important say. And I think most people
in the correct way.
In the correct way. I think the difficulty is that Italian stadiums, and above all, the Italian police attitude, is that they can do what they want. We don't want to provoke trouble. And this was clearly the attitude at the Stadio Olimpico on Saturday. And the police have said this explicitly and also off the record in the past. When there's trouble, when there's potentially trouble in the curvas with the ultras, our orders are don't make it any worse. Don't go in and arrest the ringleaders, because if you set foot in the curvas, you'd just be inciting more trouble. Now, today's Gazetta, for example, says, all right, this is going to be unpopular, maybe not today, but in a couple of days' time, when everyone's calmed down, these measures will seem unpopular to a lot of people. But what we have to do is, first of all, ban all banners, which maybe not the biggest thing. Two, really make sure that people get jail sentences when they get caught doing something that out on the street would get them a jail sentence. Should be the same in these stadiums, which doesn't really happen at the moment. But above all, Gazzetta dello Sport, biggest selling newspaper in Italy, says ban all ultra groups. Just ban them. Dissolve them, make it illegal to have an organised ultra fan group, and to all intents and purposes, therefore, any fan group, which, in terms of Italian football culture, is absolutely massive. You might say there's going to be a lot of innocent people, a lot of innocent fans, a lot of good work that the ultra groups do, and they often do good work, that would be harmed in this, but you might equally say, when you look at all the events that have happened, when you look at the atmosphere inside stadiums, that essentially it's impossible for them to go on with these groups there, enjoying the power they have, enjoying the level of blackmailing ability that they have over other fans and football clubs. And yeah, another point that's made in the Gazzetta today is that previously the bad thing about the ultras was that a lot of people felt that far-right groups have infiltrated them. There's a lot of far-right politics, and that's certainly true. The question now, and we were talking about Jenny, this guy Gennaro Di Tommaso, is that it seems like a lot of ultra groups have got very, very strong links with organised crime. A couple of years ago in Milan, people from the Curva Sud, I can't remember which fan group it was, but basically there was shootouts between rival ultras of Milan over who controls merchandise and ticket sales among the Curva. So, you know, something's got to be done. Will it be done? I don't know, because we've had so many turning points in Italy's relationship with the ultras before. I don't know, but it was just extraordinary scenes to see. As one paper put it, I think La Repubblica put it today, on Saturday, you know, the heads of the Italian state were there at the game, but they were hiding behind Marek Hamzic's back. You know, there he was standing alone under the curva. Anyway, how about that? How about that? But a terrific game afterwards, which is the main thing, and Napoli won the Coppa Italia. Shall we try...
That's a bit, anyway, Mrs. Lincoln, what did you think of the play, isn't it?
Well, yeah. But essentially with Italian football, we've grown used to this context. And, right. Let's finish off with a little bit of Liga. How about that? How about the Liga weekend? Jacob, I know you watched Sunday night's game, but it all began with Barcelona drawing with Getafe, and Sport on Sunday morning, the Catalan newspaper, saying the league is over and this team is over, which I thought was a little bit dramatic about this Barcelona side. But that's what they said. That's all over. As it turned out, though, that 2-2 draw with Getafe was almost the best result of the weekend, because, Sunday afternoon, Atletico Madrid, the team that had just put out Chelsea, the team on top of the Liga, lose 2-0. They were at Levante, weren't they?
Yeah. At Levante. They didn't have that much to play for, but they have a good defence. Sid Lowe's
like
match report
on the final day.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, didn't Sid say last week, sorry for interrupting, that if any team could sort of chisel out a result against Atletico, it would be Levante at home?
I think he probably did, Barry. Good on you, Sid.
But that was then it's seen as a missed opportunity for Barcelona to only draw against Getafe, who were in relegation trouble, weren't they? And then there was that crazy game at the Bernabeu later on, where it looked like the momentum had all swung to Real Madrid.
It was in their hands by that point. Yeah. All they had to do was win their last, three games, because they play midweek.
They've got the game in hand against Valladolid on Wednesday night.
Mm-hmm. So they went into this game with Valencia. Valencia side who don't have anything to play for.
Well, they just had the Europa League semi-final on Thursday night, where they lost in extremely dramatic circumstances, where they were 2-0 down from the first leg against Sevilla, went 3-0 up with not long to go, and then conceded a last-minute header. Then they lost, on away goals, 3-3 on aggregate. And you're thinking, well, then they're not going to have much left in the tank at all. And I think for the first 10 minutes, it kind of looked like that, because Madrid really went after them. And then suddenly, Valencia sort of survived that initial storm and came into the game more and more. They hit the bar, and then they scored. Matias scored from a corner. And then Madrid equalised straight after half-time. You're thinking, right, they're going to go and win this now. Ramos scored again. And then they go 2-1 up. It sort of feels like a sort of a Man City QPR kind of vibe, where they're 2-1 up out of nowhere. And then a crazy goal from
Ronaldo.
Now
this was in what, the 92nd
minute?
Yeah.
Ridiculous goal.
Greg hasn't seen the goal.
Was it, ball comes to Di Maria on the left side of the box, chests it, and then just kind of loops a volley cross into the middle, where Ronaldo contorts his body to lift up his right leg, I think, and flick in an absurd backheel volley from...
Is it like an Ibra Kung Fu kick?
The thing is, with Ibra, that was... When that ball came into Ibra, it was illogical. It was absurd that he scored it. But I think at the time, that felt like the only way he could have scored that goal, unless he just plain headed it, which most people would have done. But there was a logic to it. What Ronaldo did seemed to me utterly illogical. It was almost as if he decided... Because he could have volleyed it. There was a lot of things. It was coming on his front side, but instead he spun round and met it with a back heel.
He's just ridiculous.
Do you think he thought a whistle? This sounds like the kind of thing where someone thinks that the whistle has gone, and they end up doing something amazing because it's just from another planet.
It really was.
But hasn't Sid been saying a lot this season? He's been trying to score like the overhead kick. But then this wasn't quite that. But. It was. Maybe, I don't know. He scored some amazing goals.
Would you say this was better than Ibra's? Because I can't remember Ibra's properly, but I know the ball comes across and he basically puts his heel over his shoulder. Yeah.
I mean, the context of the goal to do that in the 93rd minute when you're 2-1. But after that, he then put a header wide. They had two more attacks, and you think, well, there's time enough for them to win it. And Morata, who Ronaldo doesn't seem to like very much, put a chance wide at the near post. And so what the it's now back in.
I'll tell you what it is. I did think it was interesting, though, that everyone on Twitter was calling that goal a goal a la Ibra or a la Zlatan. It was basically a Zlatan goal, which I don't think Ronaldo would be very happy about. Yeah. Anyway, the situation now is if Real Madrid win that game midweek, they will be second, 2 points behind Atletico going into the final weekend. Barcelona will be third, 3 points behind Atletico, but ready to host Atletico on that final day. It's unbelievably tight. The permutations you can find in Sid Lowe's brilliant article on the subject on The Guardian's rather brilliant website. But statistics suggest that it's very much Atletico still to lose, with Barcelona still with a fair chance. And according to Sid's article, Real Madrid only 10% of actually taking the title. Mind you, they have got a Champions League final to look forward to. Well, we'll be hopefully joined by the Sid on the Thursday to properly preview what looks like a really dramatic finale to the Liga season. Meantime, that brings us to the end of today's Football Weekly. Barry, anything else you wanted to add?
No, although we forgot to give Glenn Murray credit for a wonderful assist.
There you go.
In Palace's victory, or, well, moral victory over Liverpool.
Right, yeah. Okay, job done. Greg?
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Being emotional.
All right then, Jacob. Anything else you want to throw in?
No. Just waiting for Greg to cry. No,
nothing. It's not going to happen. It's not been that emotional. It's been emotional.
Well, you wait till Sunday.
Yeah.
All right, then, listeners, have a super one. We'll be back on Thursday. Bye for now.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.